These tapes are produced in the spirit of AA's 12th step to carry the message. Members of this fellowship should bear in mind AA's 11th tradition regarding anonymity at the level of press, TV, and films, and use of these tapes. Anonymity to this extent is actually the practice of genuine humility. We are sure that humility expressed by anonymity is the greatest safeguard that AA could ever have.
I want to welcome everybody to the Wilson House. Bill W.'s birthplace. On the kickoff to the special Bill W. celebration of the observance of his 100th birthday. Like I said before, you know, without Bill W. and without this program, none of us would be here today. I'm certain that I wouldn't be here today, that's for sure. I have a lot of gratitude. Peter L. has a archive display, which has some wonderful material up there. And just enjoy yourselves. Now, can we start with a moment of silence, and then I'll read the big book prayer? Dear God, we'd like to thank you for this beautiful day, this gracious opportunity, the wonderful life that you have given us, and for a dynamic program to live by. Please be with us in this project to reveal our knowledge of your will and what we are about to do. We pray that this will bring understanding of you to others who suffer as we have suffered. Amen. And now, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Joe and Charlie.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Charlie Parman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Charlie.
Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for 9,515 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. It's great to be back up in Vermont and back up to the Wilson Inn, getting ready to do the thing we love to do the most, which is talk about the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't realize we were going to have quite as much togetherness as we got this weekend. We're going to be real close to each other. That's great. That's great for us. We're always amazed when we're asked to come back to places and do things like this. We were quite used to before AA being asked to leave places and not come back, and it's nice to be asked to come back and repeatedly and do this thing we love to do. We always like to say as we start one of these things that Joe and I do not consider ourselves to be the gurus of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. We're just two old drunks, met together several years ago, found we had a mutual interest in the Big Book, and we began to study it together. And we've studied it together for quite some years, and hopefully we've learned a few things about it. And those few things we've learned about it, we just love to be able to share them with other people. We do not speak for AA as a whole, and you are most certainly free to agree or disagree with anything that we say as you see fit throughout the entire weekend. And if you hear us saying things that can't be reconciled with what's in the Big Book, we suggest you just don't pay any attention to that at all. And we'll try to keep those statements to the absolute minimum. We also like to say that we know and fully understand that the mind will absorb only about what the rear end will stand. And some of these sessions, as you've noticed on your program, become quite long. Two and a half hours, for instance, this session is going to be. And if you feel the need to get up and move around, please feel free to do that. That won't bother us at all. If you feel the need to go get a cup of coffee, go out inside and smoke a cigarette, or go back in there and get rid of a cup of coffee, whatever, please feel free to do that. That's not going to bother us at all. We also believe our book when it says we are meant to be joyous, happy, and free. You know, we love to laugh, we love to cut up, we love to have a good time. And from time to time this weekend, we may stop whatever we're doing, tell a little joke just to get some humor started. And if we do, and if it isn't funny, go ahead and laugh anyhow. It'll make you feel good, and it'll make the one next to you feel good. Now, in line of that, I'm going to start out with a little story that I think is very appropriate for we alcoholics. And it's a story about a brain surgeon who some years ago developed a way to transplant the human brain in its entirety. You know, we've been doing it for years and years with other organs. He found a way to do it with the brain. And this older fellow went to see him, and he said, "Doctor, I'm having trouble with my brain. It won't work right." Said, "I can't remember anything, can't figure things out. You think you might be able to help me?" And the doctor said, "Well, let's give you a physical exam. If your body's okay, if you're okay physically, well, we can probably do so." So he gave him a physical, and he told the old man, said, "Oh, yeah, your body's great. It's in fine shape." He said, "I believe I can transplant a brain in your head, and everything would work out fine." The old man said, "Well, okay. What do you have to offer, anyhow?" And the doctor said, "Well, let's go up here in the display room, and I'll show you what we have in stock at the present time." And he took him up into the room where they had the brains all on display. And he said, "Now, over here in this display case, I've got the brains of an attorney." And he said, "I could transplant this in your head. Everything would be great. Cost you $20,000. And the old man said, "Well, do you have anything else?" And he said, "Oh, yeah. In this case over here, I have the brains of a doctor." And said, "I could transplant this in your head. Everything would be fine. Cost you $50,000. The old man said, "Well, do you have anything else?" And he said, "Oh, yeah. In this case over here, I've got the brains of an alcoholic." And he said, "I could transplant this in your head. Everything would be great. Cost you $100,000. The old man said, "Man, I don't understand this deal." He said, $10,000 for the attorney brain, $50,000 for the doctor, and $100,000 for the alcoholic's brain? And the doctor said, "Well, hell yes, man. It's brand new. It's never been used before." I think most of us will go to the grave with about 50,000 miles left on the original warranty that we never even touched into, Joe.
My name is Joe, and I'm a real alcoholic.
Thanks, Bob.
Through God's grace, because this program works one day at a time in my life, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since the 10th of March, 1962. For this, I'm extremely grateful.
Well, by the way, before he goes any further, let me tell you, he's 67 years old today.
See, he likes to say that. He's going to catch up with me in April, though.
As of today, I can call him the old man.
It's great to be here. I did have to think about days like this. God has let me have 33 years of wonderful life in the program. It's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's beginning these things, each of these things that I talk about them, is we've never did two big book studies alike. Each of them is a brand new experience for Charlie and I, just as it's new for some of y'all. It's a brand new experience. We don't have any plans. We just open the book and let it happen, and whatever's supposed to happen happens. And that way we enjoy it. We look forward to this as much as anyone does. As Charlie said, some years ago I began to study the book. About 1971, I guess my motivation was to, I began to work with people, and I felt a great need to learn more about how to help alcoholics or how to work with alcoholics. I felt like the book contained the information I needed, so I began to study the book. I made very little progress And I guess that, you know, we, individually we have tunnel vision. We can't see things on our own. It's very difficult. It's one individual. I began to talk to other AA members in my community who had more sobriety than I did at that time about the big book. No one was interested in the book or the program. I began to wonder, you know, maybe I was doing something wrong, but still I continued doing this. I began somewhat of a nuisance because every time I'd see an AA member, I'd say, tell him about the big book, and they'd run off and hide, you know. And it's been off a couple of years, but I studied the book every night just a little bit and began to get some ideas about the scheme of the book, the plan, the procedure, the text. It was in 1973 that I met Charlie, and Charlie actually, we were both supposed to be from Arkansas, but Charlie lives he lives out of the state. He lives across the line. He lives actually 225 miles from me, so we were not in the same area. I hadn't met Charlie, but we met him of all places at Al-Anon conference. Can you imagine that? We met at Al-Anon. He and his wife were to be the speakers, and they asked me to introduce him. And you know, most of the time you're going to introduce somebody you never met before. And I always laugh and tell the story because I really thought I seen the name Charlie P on there, and I thought he was going to be Charlie Pratt. And this guy showed up, and he wasn't even the right color. You know. But they talked that night, you know, everybody comes up and talks to the speakers, and the chairman kind of gets back out of the way and let them visit. And after all that was over, I began to visit with Charlie. And I never forget, first thing I had on my mind all the time was my interest in the big book. And I expressed it to Charlie and told him what I was doing. I was studying the book, and he was very interested. In fact, in 2 years, he was the only person I ever seen in AA that was interested in the big book. It was immediate something there. The interest struck up between. He said, "I've been studying the book too," and so we. It began that night, I guess, the whole thing in our lives. We made plans to meet at different places, and we would go to meetings and conferences. And at these conferences, you know, we would get away on Saturday evening. We'd get in trouble doing the White Al-Anon speaker was on. We'd go into a room and study the big book and talk about the book. Over the period of time, we would make notes while we were separated and come back, and we would put the big book study was put together like you put together a little puzzle. Over a period of time, we would take this means this and this fits here, and things would go that way, and we would agree or disagree and talk about it as we went through the book. A third guy, Charlie, in Oklahoma, Charlie and I would do this, and the third guy, Tony, was the first person outside I called. I remember Charlie, we came that weekend and was at a conference, and Charlie said, "There's another guy that's interested in the book. Do you mind if he, I'm losing power?" Huh? No, he said, "It's losing the power. Now, is it working? It's coming off and on. Is it on? It's right now. Yeah, it's kind of coming and going." But we set into the, Charlie asked, could this third guy set in on our discussion? And I told him it was all right, but down inside I remember thought somebody was barging in on what we were doing. This guy became intricate. And he happens to be here today. Tony, is Tony here?
Tony back there, stand up, Tony.
That's Tony, yeah. So Tony sat in with us that day, And the next time we met, there was another one and another one and another person wanted to set in, and we didn't know what all this was about. But finally, we would end up in a hotel room, and it would be 15 or 16 people sitting on the bed, on the floor, up against the wall, and we would be talking about the big book. One time we were in Tulsa, I believe it was, and one of the guys in the room asked us, would y'all come out to Lawton, Oklahoma to put on one of these for his group? And we did, and this was in 1977, and we put on actually the first presentation of the Big Book. Four tapes were made of that. A taper got a hold of the tapes, as they always do, and the taper began to make some of these tapes and distribute them. He called the tapes the Big Book Study Tapes. So this is where the name came from, the taper. They called them the Big Book Study Tapes. These tapes were sent out, and we were invited to go through the Midwest. In 1985, we met Wesley. And I think in Omaha, Nebraska, I believe it was.
1978.
He, in turn, had a great interest in our approach to the Big Book. Wesley was a great student of the book, had been studying the book many years before Charlie and I, but he didn't have the advantage that Charlie and I had with each other. He had just a one person studying by himself. So I'll talk up as high as I can take it. he was enthused with the ideas and the approach that we had found through our study. So he felt like this thing needed to be gotten out to people. And this is when he set up the Big Book Seminars. Also, actually what he did in New Orleans in 1980, in order to get this message out, he set up, Wesley was a real alcoholic, and this guy knew how to do things. He set up, he had a lunching on a Wednesday before the convention started. He invited 1,500 people. He set all this up. These people came from all over the world, all over the United States. And then Wesley gave out, I know it's not working, he's working on it. Wesley gave out, he gave 100 sets of tapes as door prizes. And this was the way of getting the tapes out. He got the people there, and then he gave out 100 sets, give away 100 sets as door prizes. Now, the people there actually thought they won the tapes. But Wesley had picked them out because he knew where they would be sitting. He seated all the guests. And so they went back to every city, every state, and all over the world, really. And this is the way Wesley's thing of getting the message out. You know, he's a real alcoholic. He knew how to get it done. And Chai and I began to be invited to everywhere then after that. And then this is really what our lives become with the Big Book. It's none of it was planned. None of it was just, there's no plan to this today. I mean, we just sat down and talked about the Big Book. I think the most exciting thing, and what is it, we've just been some instruments in what I think has been very meaningful to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we'll be talking about it throughout the weekend, but, you know, the program in this book is the foundation of our lives. This book actually created by 100 people and published in 1939 is where our fellowship came from. All the 200,000 groups across the world came from the program in this book. Somewhere along the line, you know, we have gotten away from our program. You know, as John talked about the Washingtonians, you know, they blew away, mainly because they didn't have a program. You don't know what he did, but he's got power. He went through the steps. Okay. Okay. But anyway, through the as a result of the book, we created the groups. And somewhere along the line, you know, the groups have, what is this, has been our problem is success. That's what happens in most human movements. Success is what kills us. And we've gotten away from our program. And if we become a hollow fellowship, and we'll blow away like the Washingtonians too. So I think the Big Book Studies have been some small part of a great movement in the fellowship, not just because of us, but there seems to be a great movement in our fellowship back to the basics, back to what really created us. And I think it's been an exciting thing to be a part of that and to see really Alcoholics Anonymous going back to Alcoholics Anonymous.
Been very exciting for us.
Yeah,
that's for sure. Okay, now let's open our book and let's go to the foreword to the second edition. We're going to look at a little bit of the history. John covered practically all of this,
mm-hmm.
but a few things we want to repeat just a little bit to be able to see how it fits into the scheme of the book. And we almost have to go back and look at what happened to Bill and Bob and that first 100. In order for us to be able to understand the book today and how it's written and the sequence it's written in and et cetera. And the best place I know of to find that information is the foreword to the second edition on Roman numeral 24. And let's go to the last paragraph on that page. And there it tells us that the spark that was to flare into the first AA group was struck at Akron, Ohio in June 1935. What number did I say for that Roman numeral? Oh, I'm sorry, 15.
About 15.
Roman numeral 15. Mm-hmm. Just struck my mind. I said the wrong number. The spark that was to flare into the first AA group was struck at Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. Well, we know that New York stockbroker, of course, to be Bill Wilson, and we know the Akron physician to be Dr. Bob. And I really think we're treating Bill pretty good when we called him a New York stockbroker. He really wasn't. He was a New York City stock speculator. He made his living out of selling fast talking to slow thinking people. And the reason we say that is because Bill Wilson was a real alcoholic. We don't want to take anything away from Bill. He's a great man. But I think we all need to understand he's a real alcoholic, just like all the rest of us. One of the world's greatest con artists and a super, super salesman. Understanding about that about Bill, it makes it easier to understand the book.
Yeah.
Because he is the primary author of the book. Now, 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience. And as we get into Bill's story, we'll be able to see where Bill had in the town's hospital in the latter part of 34, what he always referred to as a vital spiritual experience, during which old ideas were cast aside and replaced with a new set of ideas, and Bill was able to leave the town's hospital and live the rest of his life without ever having to drink again because of that spiritual experience. But prior to that spiritual experience, there are certain things that had to transpire, take place, certain things that Bill had to learn. And one of them was during the meeting with the alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day. And of course, John has talked already today about Ebbie Thatcher. We won't go into that in any great detail, but we know that Ebbie and Bill were old, old school friends. They were old drinking buddies. And we know that Ebbie came to see Bill in Bill's home in the early part of, November of 1934. And he sat down with Bill in Bill's kitchen, and he gave to Bill two very valuable pieces of information. He said to Bill, people like you and I, who have become absolutely powerless over alcohol, if we're going to recover from that condition, we're going to have the aid of a power greater than human power. And he said, I've been attending meetings with a group of people called the Oxford Groupers, and they told me if I could have a vital spiritual experience, that during that experience I would find the power and I would be able to recover. He said, also, Bill, they have outlined for me a practical program of action. And they guaranteed me if I would follow that program of action, I would have the spiritual experience, I would find the power, and I would be able to recover. And he said, look at me, Bill. It's been 2 months since I've had a drink. Now, Bill knew about Ebby, and he knew how Ebby drank. And he knew that if Ebby had been sober for 2 months, that some power greater than Ebby had to be working in Ebby's life. And it made a great impression on Bill. What he actually told him, the vital spiritual experience turned out to be the solution to alcoholism. The practical program of action turned out to be the action necessary to have that vital spiritual experience. So Ebby gave him the solution and the program of action that day during that visit. He had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who is now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members, and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. From this doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism. And again, as John talked about this afternoon, Bill was put in the town's hospital as far back as the summer of 1933. And there he was withdrawn from alcohol by Dr. Silkworth, and Dr. Silkworth sat down with him, explained to him his ideas about alcoholism. And he said, Bill, I don't believe alcoholism is a matter of willpower. I don't believe it's moral character. I don't believe sin's got anything to do with it. He said, I believe people like you have an actual illness. And he said, I believe it to be a twofold illness, an illness of the body as well as an illness of the mind. And he explained to Bill his ideas about the physical allergy. And he said, I think that whenever you take a drink and put it in your body, something happens to you that don't happen to most people. And he said, I believe that that alcohol, once it gets in your body, produces an actual physical craving that makes it virtually impossible for you to stop drinking after you have once started. And he said, also, it seems to me as though people like you have developed what we call an obsession of the mind. And he said, an obsession of the mind is an idea that overcomes all ideas to the contrary. And he said, it really doesn't make any difference how badly, Bill, you want to stop drinking. From time to time, your mind is going to tell you that it's okay to drink. And based on the idea that this time it's going to be okay, you're going to take a drink, put it in the body, the physical craving will take over, you'll be unable to stop, and you'll end up drunk every time you try to drink. He said, you can no longer safely drink because of the body, and you can't stay sober because of the mind. Therefore, you've become absolutely powerless over alcohol. Now, Bill knew that in the summer of 1933. But we also know that self-knowledge wasn't enough, because he got drunk shortly thereafter, drank again, ended up staying drunk until the summer of 1934. And he went back into the towns, withdrawn from Dr. Silkworth again, and this time Dr. Silkworth pronounced him incurable and told Bill's wife, Lois, that this guy's going to have to be locked up or something. Said if we don't do something with him within a short period of time, he'll either die during DTs or he'll become a wet brain, one of the two, and you'll have to give him over to the undertaker or the asylum. And Bill heard that, and he said fear sobered him up for a bit. But he left the town's hospital, and Armistice Day, he started drinking again. So knowing the problem didn't do him any good, really, at that time. It's only after Ebby came to him and gave him the solution to that problem and a program of action necessary to find that solution that Bill was able to recover from alcoholism. And the book said, though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he was convinced of the need for moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. And we can already see the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that are contained within those tenets of the Oxford groups. Now, as Bill applied those to his life, he then recovered from alcoholism. And one of their tenets always was, is you're going to have to help other people. You can't keep it if you don't give it away. And we know that as soon as Bill recovered from alcoholism in the town's hospital, the first thing he did was go out and start trying to help other drunks. And I imagine he did like so many of us do today. He walked in the bars and he jerked them off the bar stools and he seen them up out of the gutters, and he began to talk to them about this great spiritual experience that he had had. And he said, come with me, I'll take you to a group of people, and you can have a spiritual experience also. And he's trying to sober up all them people, and most of them didn't want to sober up. And they sure as hell didn't want to sober up to a great spiritual experience. And he offended them, turned them off, and he helped nobody. Now, several months later, he was back in the town's hospital, and Dr. Silkworth had let him come there and talk to some of the drunks. And he ran into Dr. Silkworth, and he said, Doctor, I've been trying to help other people, other alcoholics. Nobody has responded to what I've been trying to do. I must be doing something wrong. And Dr. Silkworth said, yeah, I've heard about you and some of your hijinks out there, trying to cram that great spiritual experience you had up here down their throat. And he said, you don't cram anything down the throat of an alcoholic. He'll just vomit it right back up every time. He said, why don't you tell them what I told you? He said, every alcoholic I know has two questions. One, why can't I drink like I used to without getting drunk? Two, why can't I quit now that I want to? And he said, if you will explain to them the exact nature of their illness, you will get their interest. And then after you get their interest, then you can talk to them about the spiritual experience. And I don't think it's by accident that the very next person they'll talk to happened to be Dr. Bob in Akron, Ohio.
Okay. Prior to his journey to Akron, Brokaw had worked hard with many alcoholics on a theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic. But he had been successful only in keeping sober himself. He hadn't helped anyone prior to his journey to Akron. After this talk with Dr. Silkworth, in his business life, this opportunity that came up to go to Akron, they were having a proxy fight in a company out there, and these people in New York send Bill out there to lead this proxy fight. Okay, Brokaw had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear he might drink again. And we know the deal fell through. He lost the vote in the proxy fight. He was standing in the hotel, and he was pretty down in the dumps, and we know the story. He suddenly realized, in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. This alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. In New York, even when he wanted to drink or he had gotten a bad problem, he always worked with another alcoholic. He never helped anyone. So in Akron, he thought about the same thing. So we know how he got in touch with Dr. Bob, and they said this physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcohol dilemma, but failed. We also look at the fact that Dr. Bob was already in the Oxford groups in Akron. In fact, he had been in for 2.5 years. Bill had just been in the program for 6 months. But Dr. Bob couldn't stay sober. But when the Brokaw gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and his hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never been able to muster. Dr. Bob had this. He thought the solution was spiritual. He had the same recovery program of the Oxford group, the planned program of action, but he couldn't use it. But up to this point, before Dr. Bob met Bill, he thought the problem was a sin. He thought it was a sin. When Bill told him about the allergen obsession, then he began to apply the solution and the program of recovery, and he recovered. So there were two people at that time with these little pieces of information. There were two people who understood their problem, understood their solution, and they had filed a program of action to find that solution. So there were two people who had this information at this time.
I think this is one of the first great miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. How this old Conan speculating, New York City stock speculator, could sit down with this well-trained surgeon and explain to the surgeon what was wrong with his mind and his body. Normally the doctor would have said, who are you to be telling me? But the message had such depth and such interest that Dr. Bob bought into it immediately, applied their little program, and he recovered also, sober never to drink again up to the moment of his death in 1950. Now this seemed to prove two things that our whole fellowship is founded upon. This seemed to prove first that one alcoholic could affect another, as no non-alcoholic could. Dr. Bob said to his wife, Ann, I'm going to go over there and give that guy 15 minutes of my time, and then I'm coming back home. And he went over there, and they sat down in a room by themselves, and they talked literally for hours. And when Dr. Bob came out of there, he said, this is the first man I ever met that knew what he was talking about it when it comes to alcoholism. And here's how Bill did it. He didn't go in there and say, Dr. Bob, you've got this physical allergy. You've got this obsession of the mind. He didn't talk to Dr. Bob about Dr. Bob's drinking. Everybody else had already done that, and Bob was sick of hearing that stuff. Bill sat down there, and he said, let me tell you about my drinking. And he began to tell his story. And as he told about the many, many, many times that he was just going to have one or two drinks, but then he would take one or two, and then he couldn't stop, and he may not get home for a day or a week or whatever. And Dr. Bob said, you know, by golly, that's what's been happening to me. He identified with Bill immediately. And Bill said, well, now, there's a little doctor named Dr. Silkworth in New York City that explained to me that this thing is a physical allergy and we're different from other people. As he told his story, he told about the literally hundreds of times that he had sworn off drinking, never going to take another drink long as he lived. And he said, I have a tremendous amount of willpower. And Bill did. But he said, when it comes to alcohol, I always end up believing it's okay to drink, and I go right. Dr. Bob said, hey, man, that's what's been wrong with me. And Bill said, well, this same doctor told me that's, in other words, through sharing his story, he helped Dr. Bob see Dr. Bob's problem. One alcoholic sharing with another. And that seemed to prove that this is the best way to do that. You see, Bill had never tried this before. He had always gone in there talking to him about the need for the great spiritual experience. This time he talked about the exact nature of the illness, and it worked immediately. It also seemed to prove, it also indicated, that strenuous work one alcoholic with another was vital to permanent recovery. Now remember, Bill didn't go see Dr. Bob to sober up Bob. Bill was standing in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel about to get drunk. He had already looked through the door into that bar. He had already started in there once. And I guess the music was great, and the lights were low, and the smoke was thick, and the laughter was fine. And he said, I can go in there with you people of my kind, and I'll feel better. But as he started through the door, he said, no, Bill, you can't do that. If you go in there, you're going to get drunk. And in desperation, he remembered how back in New York City, even though he had never helped anybody, every time he had tried, he himself had felt better. And he said, I've got to find me a drunk. And he got hold of Dr. Bob to keep Bill sober. And it worked. And we're still working on the same two things today. You know, one alcoholic working with another, not only helps the new alcoholic, but it keeps the older alcoholic sober also. Now, as soon as Dr. Bob got sober, they said to each other, okay, man, now if we're going to stay sober, we're going to have to give this to other people. And the book says, hence the two men set to work almost frantically upon alcoholics arriving in a ward of the Akron City Hospital. The very first case, they desperately recovered immediately and became AA number 3. And of course we know this is Bill Dodson, and we know this is the picture you see in AA rooms all over the world, the man on the bed. And they called up down and talked to the head nurse, Dr. Bob Dutt, and he said, I've got a rum hound here from New York City with me, and we need another drunk to talk to. We think we found a way to stay sober, and we believe we could help one. Do you have anybody? And she said, oh yeah. Said, man, we got one locked up there. And said, he's a real corker. He's just blacked both eyes of one of the nurses. Said, come on up and talk to him. And then before she hung the phone up, she said, oh, by the way, Dr. Bob, have you tried it on yourself yet? So they go up and they talk to Bill Dodson. And they sit down and they tell Bill Dodson their story. They don't talk to Bill Dodson about Bill Dodson's drinking. Hell, everybody else had already done that. He was sick of that stuff. They talked about their drinking. And Bill's eyes opened up. And he could see where he had that same allergy. He could see where he had that same obsession of the mind. He could see the hopeless condition of the body and the mind and the need for spiritual help. Bill Dodson said to his wife 2 days later, get my clothes out of the closet. I'm going home. And he got up, put his clothes on, went home, applied the little program of action, and he recovered also. Never to drink again up to the moment of his death. Now then, it made three of them. And they continued to work throughout that summer. It said this work at Akron continued through the summer of 1935. There were many failures, but there was an occasional heartening success. You know, we always give credit to Bill, Bob, the first 100. Rightfully, we should. But I think maybe we need to stop sometimes and think about the people they failed with. Now, that summer of 1935, they didn't really know what they were doing. Everything they did was on a trial and error method. They would try something. If it worked, they would retain it. If it didn't, they would discard it, try something else. And Dr. Bob, one of his favorite things in trying to build the body up was to fill them up with sauerkraut juice. Can you imagine coming off a hangover drinking sauerkraut juice? But it had some vitamins in it that he felt that the body needed. And they tried that amongst many other things, and every once in a while one of these guys would fall over dead. I can almost see Bill had turned to Bob and say, "Man, let's don't do that again." I think maybe we ought to give credit to those they failed with. They probably learned more from the failures than they did the successes that summer. When the broker returned to New York in the fall of 1935, the first AA group had actually been formed, though no one realized it at the time. When he went back to New York City, he left behind him a few individuals who were members of the Oxford groups. But from the very beginning, the alcoholics had some problems with the Oxford groupers. Now, the Oxford groupers really were not into the business of sobered up drunks. What they really wanted to do was to work with a better class of person, leaders in the city structure, leaders in the state structure, leaders in the country structure, and eventually straighten out the whole world through this program. And they were having trouble with the drunks. You know, the drunks would stand around in the corners and tell dirty stories, smoke cigarettes, spill coffee on the carpets, and the Oxford groupers wasn't too crazy about that. Now, the Oxford groupers also had a thing they called the Four Absolutes, where you were to practice absolute love, absolute purity, absolute honesty, and absolute unselfishness. And the drunks were having a hell of a time being anything absolute except drunks. And they didn't go for that Oxford group deal as far as the absolutes are concerned. So to separate themselves from the regular Oxford groupers, they began to call themselves the drunk squad of the Oxford groups. That's what Bill left behind him. Later it would become the first AA group, but it was known then as the drunk squad of the Oxford group.
Okay, by the late 1937, a number of members having substantially sobered the time behind him was convinced the membership that a new light had entered the dark world of the alcoholic. After 1935, Bill went back to New York in September 1935. When he went back to New York, he didn't go back running around telling the drunks about his spiritual experience. Uniquely, he began to apply what he learned in Akron. He went back telling the people about, he would show them their problem, and then he would show them solution, and then he would talk about his spiritual experience. People began to get sober in New York. In late 1937, he was back in Akron to visit with Dr. Bob, and
again on a business venture.
Again on this same business venture which never worked. They began to think about the second small group that had probably taken shape in New York. Beside there were scattered alcoholics who picked up the basic ideas in Akron or New York and were trying to form AA groups in other cities. And in his talk with Dr. Bob there, he visited in the home there on Ardmore, Dr. Bob's house. I could just see him visiting there in the kitchen. They began to talk and they found out there were 40 people sober with these three little ideas. It was never, they never thought to keep it to themselves. They were thinking about how they could get this out to other people. So it was now time the struggling group thought to place their message and unique experience before the world. Now, Bill and Dr. Bob did not want to deal with this. They had some ideas, but they couldn't arrive at any conclusion what they wanted to do. It's very peculiar that we begin with the group conscious. No, they said, well, let's call a meeting of all the Oxford Group members in Akron and see, let them make this decision. So that night in the Williams home, they had a meeting there, and there were 18 people at this meeting. You know, Charlie and I were out in California, I think it was last year, and we met a lady out there, Williams's daughter, and she was a teenager at home, and she had made the coffee and the sandwiches for this meeting, and her boyfriend went out on a little date.
Went to the movies
of the night they had this meeting, and these 18 people. And at that meeting, they decided to do three things. It's very peculiar. First thing they decided to do was to build a chain of hospitals across the United States. Now, it's in a depression, and they don't have a dime, but they're going to build a chain of hospitals.
Real alcoholics. Dr. Bob probably going to be the head doctor, too.
Yeah. The second thing they decided to do, they would hire and train a group of paid missionaries to carry this message.
Bill was probably going to be the head missionary.
The third and final thing they decided to do was write a book. And the reason they felt it very essential that they needed a book, because already the little program that they had come up with in 2 years of being passed around from one member to the other, word of mouth, was already getting diluted. And they felt like to preserve the message, it had to be put down into a written form. Also, they felt like at this time, you know, the Oxford groups had written a lot of books, a lot of great books. This was before TV. I don't know if you can imagine life before TV, but a lot of books were being sold, and books were big, you know, magazines and newspapers and publications were big things. People read a lot. People bought a lot of books. The Oxford Group sold a lot of their books. And Bill felt like, you know, if it was a comprehensive book on alcoholism, the very first one, which it was, that this book would be such a great seller that they would make enough money off of this book to build the hospitals and hire the missionaries. So this was the ideas behind the writing of the book when they began in 1937. This termination bore fruit in the spring of 1939 by the publishing of this volume. Now this sounds like all they had to do was sit down and write it, but it wasn't that easy. We'll talk later on about it was a very difficult thing and a task that Bill had of writing this book. But it was finished in 1939.
And the first Alcoholics Anonymous that the world ever saw was a book like this one I have in my hand.
Yeah.
And it had a title on the front of it, Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you'll notice that the dust jacket is real bright red and yellow and etc. Remember, these guys are real alcoholics. They call this the circuit jacket. And I'm sure that they knew that that would attract people's eyes and they would buy more books because of the jacket. Also, if you look in the display that Pete has back there, there is a first printing, first edition in there. And it is a bright red book, gold letters on it. And it's much, much bigger than this book. That's why they called it the big book. Now, the size of the printed page in there is exactly the same as this book. But they made the margins real wide, top, bottom, and side, which made it a much bigger book. And they knew that the bigger the book, the better it's going to sell. You'll also notice on that one in the display case, it's a real thick book. And they printed it on the cheapest old paper they could find, because cheap paper is thick. And the thicker the book, the more information it must contain, therefore it's going to sell better. Now later on, they were restored to sanity, got it down to the size of this one, and used a better quality paper in it. But this book says just as much as that great big one back there does, too. Now, in this book is the story of how the first 100 men and women recovered from alcoholism.
Okay.
And John got into it some today. We'll just briefly review that. They really didn't even know what they wanted to name the book.
Yeah.
And several names came up, such as Comes the Dawn, which I think would be a very appropriate name for this thing. Another one was The Way Out.
Yeah.
which had been a good name. Another one was The 100 Men, which would have been a fine title for this book, except a woman showed up and screwed that title up. They couldn't very well use it. At one time, Bill's ego got involved. He said, well, let's call it the BW Movement. And the rest of them shot that down. And finally, somebody said, well, we are alcoholics, and we do want to remain anonymous. Those words had been flying around quite a little bit, and they said, let's call the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, after the book was published, our book today says, the fledgling society, which had been nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its own book. In other words, the drunk squads of the Oxford group now begin to call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 1939, when the book was published, the program in the book was identical to the program in the fellowship. The 100 people who made up the fellowship practiced the program in the book, and they had recovered from alcoholism. Mm-hmm. So there was no conflict between the book program and the fellowship program in 1939.
Okay. You know, but we know the book has been unchanged. We have never, you know, we changed the stories in the back of the book, but the program of recovery has never been changed one word. So it's the same identical program that we had in 1939. But the program, like humans, the program in the fellowship has changed drastically. You know, we have brought so many new things. Everybody brings something new into the fellowship. Many years ago, people, and I don't know, in the early days, I think up through when I first come in, people came off the streets. They came directly from their homes or whatever situation they was in, straight to AA.
And they didn't come out of treatment centers because they didn't have hardly any of them in those days.
People came from home, whatever situation they was in, straight to AA. After the treatment centers opened up, people no longer did that. People went to treatment centers, and 3 out of 4 people who came to AA came from treatment centers. And in the treatment centers, they were indoctrinated with other methods and other situations. And then they brought those into AA. You know, you go to meetings a day and you don't know where you're at sometimes. It sounds like group therapy. Everybody talks about what's wrong with them and what's wrong with their problems. And, you know, sometimes a child and I say, if you didn't read the preamble, you wouldn't know what kind of meeting you were in. I went to one place in the meeting and I looked at Charlie and his people was going on and I told him, I said, this show would be a good place to start an AA meeting. You know? So we're not going to be talking about the program and the fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we're going to be talking this week about the program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think what I like to tell everybody, what I do for myself is I like to listen and get involved and see what we have, look at our program in our book, and then go back to our groups and listen to the program in our group and see how far we have gotten away from what really created the fellowship. You know, the fellowship came from this book. It wasn't but 100 people, and they printed this book. And this book created the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The book itself did that, right? And we seem to be drift away from our roots. And I think it's very essential to not only to us, but the people yet to come, right? That we preserve what really, what's the basic program of Alcoholics Anonymous in our groups and in our fellowship. You know, but we can't stay sober without the fellowship, because the fellowship is the vessel that carries this great message, right? But the message must be remained intact.
Yeah, I think another thing happened even before the treatment centers came into the picture is as the fellowship began to grow, mm-hmm. and get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the groups went from 3 or 4 people to 8, 10, 11, and 12, then to 20, 25, 30, 40, 50, 60 people in the groups. They begin to find out something the original members didn't have, that there is great power in the fellowship. You know, they didn't have much fellowship in the beginning. They couldn't go to 90 meetings in 90 days. They didn't have those meetings to go to. But as AA grew, and they began to realize that maybe we can stay sober on fellowship only. Now, this book deals with recovery. They begin to talk, though, instead of recovery, they begin to talk about staying sober. And they begin to realize that they might be able to stay sober without going to the extent or the depth that the book required. Yeah. And they begin to question the need for some of the steps. And they begin to say such things as, do we really need to share all our life story with another human being? Could we not keep some of it to ourselves? They begin to question the need of the removal of all the character defects. You know, they said, couldn't we keep one or two of these? They begin to question the need of making complete amends to all people they had harmed. And they begin to water the program down. And then they begin to say, well, you can work the program any way you want to. And then came in the terms, you can treat it like a cafeteria. Take what you want, leave what you want. And then came in the idea that instead of working, talking about working on steps, let's start talking about today's problems. Yeah. And we started going to meetings and discussing today's problems. What did the boss do to me today? Or what was it the wife said today? Or the screaming kids last night? And then from there, we finally went into a group therapy session. And I think the group therapy is what really came out of the treatment centers.
Yeah.
And we begin to sit around in groups trying to psychoanalyze our problems. And we begin to talk about dysfunctional families. We begin to talk about chemical dependency. We begin to talk about dysfunctional sex. We begin to talk about all these other things other than recovery. And naturally, when we did that, then the recovery rate began to go down. Today, you go to many of these AA meetings, and as Joe says, if they didn't read the preamble before the meeting, I swear to God, you wouldn't know what kind of meeting you're in. Because they talk about everything except alcoholism and recovery therefrom. We call those meetings group depression meetings. You go in there feeling pretty good. Hell, halfway through the meeting, you might as well just blow your brains out. There's no sense in it. So what we're going to talk about all weekend... What we're going to talk about all weekend is not the program in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous today. We're going to talk about the program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which was the program in the Fellowship in 1939. And just maybe someday, we can get our fellowship back into the basic program. Now let us show you how effective this thing used to be. Whenever the program in the Fellowship... And the program practiced, the program in the Fellowship and the program in the book was exactly the same. Exactly. Let's go over to Roman numeral 20 exactly. For just a moment. Up at the top of the page, it says, public acceptance of AA grew by leaps and bounds. For this, there were two principal reasons, the large numbers of recoveries and reunited homes. These made their impressions everywhere. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses. And among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. So if my figures are right, in the beginning, 75% of the people that came here and practiced this program recovered from alcoholism. Now, I wonder what our recovery rate is today in AA. Is it 75%? Is it 50%? Is it 25%? Is it even 10%? No. People are coming to AA today, staying for a week or two or three or four or five or a month or two, go out and get drunk, and they say, well, I tried AA and AA doesn't work for me. No, the problem is they didn't work for AA. Now, we tend to blame that on the newcomer, but I don't really believe it's the newcomer's fault. The newcomer comes in here, and naturally, they want to talk about whatever it is that they know. That's a natural thing. I think what's happened to us is we old-timers got so inundated by the newcomers and their conversation was so different than ours that we begin to say to ourselves, I just can't identify with those new people coming in AA. And the old-timer began to stay home from the meeting and turned it over to the sickest of the sickest, who are the newcomers. And then the old-timer stands back and says, look what they're doing to our AA. No, I think it's our fault. I think we need to stand up to the newcomer and say, look, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The program of recovery is in the book. And all that jazz you want to talk about is probably important to you, but it doesn't belong in here. What belongs in here is the program in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Then take that newcomer by the hand. Lead them through the steps so they can have their spiritual experience. Now, we used to call that sponsorship back years ago. Our newcomer came in the door, and we were so glad to see him that we just latched on to him and put him into the book.
Right.
Today, we got so many newcomers, we don't care anymore. You see, we've become a victim of our own success. And just maybe, if you and I would do what we're supposed to do in AA, we might get that recovery rate back up again. Maybe not 75%, but surely, surely we could do a better job than what we're doing today.
Right.
And I just don't think it's the newcomer's fault. I think that's our responsibility. And if we don't do that, well, then we abdicate our responsibility. And if AA fails, we can't blame it on anybody but ourselves. That's all the preaching we're going to do. No more preaching this weekend, guarantee you, Joe.
Okay. Now that we have looked and saw the real seeds of the program, we now begin to look at the book. We go to the table of contents on page 5, Roman number 5, and see how this is put together. We know that...
In your handout materials, you have a little package, and it has these pictures in it.
Yeah.
So if you can't see the pictures from the back of the room,
you have your package.
In your
now let's look at the plan of the textbook. And the plan of the book is laid out. Remember, the first 100 were telling us what they'd done, how they recovered. So this book is written on that same identical plan that they discovered. Now, we know this is not a new plan. This is not anything new. There are many, many problems in the world. We're talking about the problem of alcoholism. That's just one problem. But there are many, many problems that we face, that humans face in the world. We got financial problems. We got medical problems. We got marital problems. We got all types of problems. Many varieties of problems. But we also know there is one simple plan that is used to solve all problems. And there's a step-by-step procedure to solve any problem. The first step in recovery from a problem is to gather all the information and find out what is the problem. That don't make no difference whether it's you. If your roof leaking, or your car stops, or your marriage, or your finance, that is what you have to do. First, you have to find out what is the problem. That's the basic information. A diagnosis. In the case of an illness, we go to a professional, and a professional makes a diagnosis to find out what is the problem. Alcoholism is a unique illness. And it's the only illness in the world that the patient has to make a self-diagnosis. Okay? This is what makes it tough. Also, the disease itself is the only disease that tells the patient he ain't got it. That's why you can swear the one that's got it. The one that swears he ain't got it has got it.
The one that says he might be, oh, he's not alcoholic.
No, the one that says he might be, he ain't. Okay. It's the one that ain't got it, it's got it. So the first step in recovery from any problem is a diagnosis to find out what is the problem. That, our book says, that is a foundation of our recovery. Foundation is based on that. Because it's from the problem. Once you gather the problem, is going. We're going to find that information in the textbook, in the doctor's opinion, and Bill's story.
some of it in chapter 2 and 3, yeah. But most of it, the doctor's opinion and Bill's story.
This is the section of the book that is going to describe the exact nature of our problem. We're going to look at our problem as allergy and obsession, as we talked about. We're going to go through those in great detail. And we find out that that describes our problem, which it says that step one is a statement of the problem. Step one is a problem statement. The problem is we're powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. That's the statement of the problem. Now, and the conclusion is we are powerless. Now, once you see that you're powerless, then you can see the solution would be power, obviously, the book says. That is laid out in chapters 2. There is a solution. More about alcoholism, we agnostic. These three chapters will help us see and understand the solution, which is power. If you are powerless over alcohol, the solution is power. And step two is a statement of the solution. The solution is power working in the mind. We don't know anything about the allergy, but we believe the solution would be power working in the mind. Therefore, I came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So once you establish those two steps, you have the problem, and the solution is power. Now then we come to the main part of the textbook, the main part of the program, the main task. If you are powerless and the solution is power, then the main job would be, how do you find this power? And that is laid out in how it works, into action, and working with others, the lies, the plan, program of action. The last 10 steps of the program, or a program of action if taken, will enable you to find the power in step 2 that will solve the problem in step 1. So we're going to look at a simple plan. We're going to look at number 1, powerless, solution power, and then how do we find this power? And then we can find the problem, see the solution, take the program of action, we can find that power, and we can recover from alcoholism.
Now remember that when Abby came to see Bill, Bill had already been with Dr. Silkworth. Bill already knew what the problem was, but he didn't have a solution till Abby came to see him. And Abby brought him the solution and the program of action. When Bill went to see Dr. Bob, Bob knew the solution and the program of action, but he didn't know the problem. It's only when those two guys could see all three things that they were able to recover. Then they went to Bill Dotson, who knew none of them.
He got all three of them.
And they gave him all three of them, and he recovered. So as we go through the book this time, I think you've got to bear in mind that they're giving us this same information that they carried to Bill Dotson. And in the same sequence, the book's going to show us the problem, then the solution, then the program of action. And then we can follow that program of action, and we can recover too. Very simple procedure. Okay, let's go over for just a moment, getting a few ideas out of the way before we get into the doctor's opinion. Let's go to Roman numeral 11. And let's look at the preface for just a moment. Now the second paragraph says, because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for both the second and the third editions. I think there's two ideas here. First, it's become the basic text for our society. And I think when we see the words basic text, we're alerted to the type book that we have in front of us. You know, there's lots of books in the world today, all kinds. We've got novels. We've got novels written on fact, novels written on fiction. We have biographies, autobiographies. We could name any kind of books. We also have a type book that we call a textbook. And many of us, when we remember textbooks, we have an aversion to that word because we don't remember them too fondly. Remember how when we went to school, we had to take textbooks and we had to sit down with them and we had to study with them, we had to take tests on them, forcing us to do things we didn't like to do. So many of us has an aversion to the idea of a textbook. But I think if we would look at a textbook in its simplest form, it's nothing more than a way to transfer information from the mind of one human being through the written word to the mind of another human being, thereby increasing the knowledge of the user of the book. And by the way, that's all teaching is too. Today in AA you hear people saying you can't teach. Well, I don't know why you can't teach. Teaching is nothing more than transference of information from one mind to another, increasing the knowledge of the one that's being taught. We all teach every day, and we're all being taught every day. There's nothing wrong with textbooks and teaching if we want to learn. A textbook will nearly always assume that the reader of the book will know very little about the subject material. It usually starts at a very simple level. Then as you progress through the book and the knowledge of the reader of the book becomes more and more, the information presented becomes more difficult. For instance, a textbook on mathematics. Now let's say that my friend Joe here knows nothing at all about mathematics. He can't add, he can't subtract, he can't do any of those things. Oh, he can count. In fact, he could probably count to 21 if he's standing there naked and got everything where it ought to be. He could probably count to that. Last time I said that, he said, no, 20 and a half. That's all we could count to. I walk up to him and I say, Joe, I've got a textbook on mathematics. Chapter 5 has algebra problems. I'd like you to go to Chapter 5 and work those problems. Well, being a good fella, he'd go to 5 and look at it. But he can't even add and subtract. Algebra problems, that's just a bunch of scratch marks on paper to him. But if I say, Joe, this textbook on mathematics, Chapter 1 deals with the value of numbers and addition and subtraction. And if you'll read it and study it and ask questions when you need to and let me help you, by the time you're through with Chapter 1, you'll know how to add and subtract. And sure enough, he learns how to do that. And I say, now, based on what you learned in 1, you can go to Chapter 2 and learn how to multiply and divide. And then you can go to Chapter 3 and learn fractions and decimals. And gradually, we prepare his mind for the new information in Chapter 5. I think one of the greatest mistakes in AA today is we hand the newcomer the big book, we say, go to Chapter 5, do what it says, and you'll be all right. And they go to Chapter 5, they open her up, and they run into a series of algebra problems. Step 1 said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, our lives had become unmanageable. The newcomer said, man, I'm not powerless over anything. They have no idea what we mean by that statement. Step 2 said, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Newcomer said, don't tell me I'm crazy. Oh yeah, I do stupid things when I'm drunk, but when I'm sober, I'm like other people. They have no idea what we mean by that statement. Well, if you're not powerless and you're not nuts, then you don't need to be thinking about turning your will in your life over to care of something you don't understand in the first place. We present them with an impossible situation. If we can do nothing else all weekend, I hope we'll all be able to see the idea of the textbook theory, and each chapter dovetails and fits in just exactly where it belongs, to give us a new idea, to take us to the next, to take us to the next, to take us to the next, and prepare us for Chapter 5. See, Chapter 5 starts with Step 3, and it's very difficult to start with 3 if you don't have 1 and 2 behind you. I hope we can see that this weekend. The other thing that's so important here is because it's helped such large numbers of men and women, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the recovery program has been left untouched. This is the first edition. The second edition came out in 1955. The third edition came out in 1976. And the only change is made. The stories in the back of this book are nearly all men, and they're all pretty low bottom. In 55, they said, now look, the stories in the back of the book no longer reflect the membership in AA. Bottom was coming up, age was coming down, more and more women coming in. They said, we need to do something about that. And all they did was take some of these stories out, put some more stories in, and came out with a second edition. And the same thing happened in 1976. So the recovery program has never been changed. Why? Well, I think it's simple. It works just as good today as it did in 1939. Why? Well, first, alcoholics haven't changed. They're still doing the same thing today they did in 39. They get drunk. They get in car wrecks. They get in knife fights. They get in jailhouses. They get in divorce courts. And they get in hospitals. They're still doing all the fun things today that they were doing in 1939. Alcoholics haven't changed a lick. Alcohol hasn't changed. The bottles have changed, the colors have changed, the names have changed, but alcohol is exactly the same as it was in 39. Human nature never changes. It's the same today as it was in 1939. So if alcoholics haven't changed, alcohol hasn't changed, human nature hasn't changed, then there's no need to change the program of recovery. It works just as good today as it did in 39, whatever age that you might be. We have never found, I think that's the second great miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, that collectively we've never found it necessary to change the recovery part of the book. Let's go to the forward to the first edition, first paragraph. Roman numeral 13. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Now, used to, I said in those few sentences, we had two things to look at. Today, I say we got three. First, we are more than 100 men and women. Most books that I read have been authored by one person. And when I read a one-person, one-author book, and I see something in there I don't agree with my keen intellectual alcoholic mind, I usually say, who are they to think they're smarter than I am? And I just ignore that information and go on. But if I do that with a big book, I'm not going to be arguing with one. I'm going to be arguing with 100 men and women. You know, the first 40 told Bill, they said, Bill, we want you to write the book. But they said, Bill, this is not to be your book. It's to be our book. And as you write it, we want to see the chapters. And we will add to, delete from, change around, whatever we think's necessary. When we're through with it, it'll be the collective knowledge, experience, and wisdom of all 40 of us. Well, by the time the book was published, that 40 had changed to 100. So I think if I argue with it today, I need to realize I'm arguing with 100, not just one. And I'm arguing with 100 who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Recovered. You know, people in AA talk today like you can't recover. You can recover from alcoholism. If we couldn't recover from alcoholism, we'd be in one hell of a shape. We'll never be cured of alcoholism. You know, before AA, I lived in a hopeless condition that involved both the body and the mind. I could not drink without getting drunk, and I could not stay sober left on my own resources. And I had to live in that hopeless condition, and I thought there would be no into this except death. After I came to AA and worked this program, I still can't successfully drink, but by golly, I can stay sober. I don't live in that hopeless condition of mind and body any longer. I'm still an alcoholic. I'll always be an alcoholic. I'm not cured of alcohol, but what I have done is recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body known as alcoholism. That's the great news we got to carry to a newcomer.